is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Mihai Raducanu from Gannon Baker Basketball, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Curly was the best, man. He really was. I was really close to Curly. In fact, I would shave the back of his head for him. He would shave his head before games, you know, to make sure it's nice and clean. Back in those days, it was like, you know, all you had was like people like Telly Savalas with the bald head. It wasn't, you know, that big until Michael Jordan kind of brought it into being cool.
Lionel Garrett is currently an assistant basketball coach for the women's team at Wilberforce University in Ohio. Garrett was an NBA draft pick of the San Diego Clippers, an international player, and a Harlem Globetrotters star. Lionel has over 30 years of basketball coaching experience with the NCAA, CBA, WBA, ABA, and FIBA. He is also an NCAA record-setting rebounder, averaging 16 rebounds per game during his career at Southern University. Garrett has coached internationally in Saudi Arabia, Italy, and Mexico. He's also spent time coaching in the CBA. A high school and college Hall of Famer, Garrett has been named Coach of the Year and been awarded GM of the Year honors twice during his coaching career. After being drafted and signed with the NBA's San Diego Clippers, Lionel became the designated rebounder of the Hall of Fame Harlem Globetrotters. He later continued his basketball playing career in Spain and the CBA. Garrett is also the owner and head coach of Rebound Doctor, an Ohio-based skill development company. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and Cavaliers Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Reach out to me at mike@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. You're going to love this episode with Rebound Doctor Lionel Garrett, assistant women's coach at Wilberforce University and a former Harlem Globetrotter.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are very pleased to be able to welcome to the podcast from Wilberforce University and Rebound Doctor Lionel Garrett. Lionel, welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Mike, I'm really privileged to be here. I really appreciate you inviting me.
We are very excited to be able to have you on. You have such a diverse background in the game, the things that you were able to accomplish and do as a player, and then as you moved on into your coaching career and just having an impact on young people. I'm so excited to be able to dive into all those things with you. Let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. And tell us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
You know, that's a good question. I started playing basketball when I was in the seventh grade and in the playground at school during recess. Saw the kids over there playing. So I said, well, let me go over there and see what that is. Didn't really know a whole lot. But what I quickly discovered is I could jump real high. And so, you know.
I never discovered that, Lionel. I kept discovering I couldn't jump.
The running joke at camp was, can Mike touch the net? So.
How I discovered that, though. You know, I'm going up for a rebound, of course. And I come down flat on my back and knocks the wind out of me, like really bad. It takes several minutes for me to catch my breath, you know, and I never forgot that. I got up, I caught my breath, I kept playing, and I've been in love with the game ever since then. So that is what started me playing basketball.
All right. Go ahead. Keep going. Keep going.
Yeah. And so as time progressed, and I was a little taller than the other kids, the coaches became pretty interested in me because I was already a natural athlete and I was growing pretty tall. And so I grew up in California and I was at Golden West Middle School. And so I made the eighth grade team, and then I went on to high school and made the ninth grade team. It was really outstanding. Everything just started happening fast for me as far as learning how to play. Played at Vanden High School in Fairfield, California, where I was growing up. My father was in the Air Force. And so that caused us to move around a lot. At the end of my ninth grade in high school, he was stationed in Guam. And so we moved here to Dayton, going into the 10th grade. And that's when things really started moving fast for me as far as my love and my progress in basketball, which really happened pretty fast as a player. So while I was growing up in California, I used to read about players who made All City and all these different things in New York City, the Rutgers tournament. And, you know, I looked up to that type of stuff. And so when I moved here to Dayton, I had a goal. I wanted to make All City. So move here in the 10th grade and I'm able to play varsity, but I don't make All City. We go into the next season, my 11th grade season, and I do make All City. I make the second team. So I'm progressing really quick. And the reason I'm progressing is because I'm determined. I stayed. We didn't have player development the way we have today. My player development was the park. And me and my friends, we play all night, just working on our games. So we were our own player development. And so that led me to my senior year. And I made All-City, first team All-City and all everything. And so I was pretty much on my way. I decided after my sophomore year that I love this game and I'm going to keep going.
Did you play any other sports besides basketball when you were growing up?
In the ninth grade, I tried football and also, also long jumps. But I didn't complete either one because I just wanted to spend all of my time just, you know, practicing and trying to become a better basketball player.
All right, talk to me a little bit about the importance of playground basketball in your life and how I'm gonna put a word in your mouth and I'm assuming you're gonna back it up. Maybe you won't, but how sad are you about the demise of outdoor playground basketball as a whole around the country? There are obviously still some pockets where people are playing outdoors, but it's nothing like I'm sure when you were a kid or when I was a kid, that's the way we grew up, was playing on the playground outdoors. And nowadays, kids, especially kids who are at the top level of high school basketball, those kids are flying around the country and playing in beautiful gyms and doing all these things, but they're not they're not getting the education that you and I got out on the playground. So just talk a little bit about your experiences on the playground and just how sad you are to see it having sort of disappeared.
Right. Yeah. Well, let me answer. I don't know if I feel sad about that because I know that things change. And I kind of see how things change with the generations at this time. And AAU completely changed everything. I didn't have AAU when I was coming up. So there was not different teams that I could apply for to play with. That wasn't the dominant thing as it is now. The playground became the place where you had to prove yourself. And all of the best talent, you know, we're at the best playgrounds and that's where you wanted to be. And I felt, I knew at that time that I had to play against the best talent that I could find in the city in order to improve and really enjoy the game. So the playground was like the grind, you know, it in essence was everything that's happening now, except for it was outside in the playground. You know, you that's where I got my player development. That's where I got my toughness, you know, because I've been in some playground situations where, you know, somebody driving by and bullets are flying, tapping off the backboard, you know, and everybody's trying to run and cover and, you know, and to the most beautiful playgrounds, the shaded trees. And that's what I used to always look for, the kind of really nice, beautiful ones, and playing against greats. Here, one of the all-time great players of University of Dayton was Donald Smith, and he's since passed away. But, you know, he kind of put me on his under his wings. He was still in high school when I met him here in Dayton, and he took me to all of the main playgrounds. So I kind of just got, you know, I cut my teeth and grew up in the playground. And then, of course, that branched into playing inside gyms.
Absolutely. All right. So let me ask you this. What was the balance when you were, let's say, from grade 10 to grade 12? What was the balance in the summertime of time that you spent playing on the playgrounds, trying to get better that way, versus the amount of time you put in by yourself at a court trying to get better? How would you maybe split those percentages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, thinking back on that, there was actually a basketball court just right up the street from where I live. And so, you know, in the summer times, every morning I had a routine. So I was going to go, I would dribble my basketball up to the playground, and I would be on a rim by myself. And I would probably spend about 4 or 5 hours out there, you know, come back in, drink some milk, get a sandwich, you know, and then I get with my friends. And then we start our little tour. We would go around to all the playgrounds, you know, to see where the games are, you know, and that would take me into the evening time. So, but to answer your question, I probably spent half of my time, you know, just kind of by myself on the course. And then in the evening time, when we were finished playing in the playgrounds, because everybody's gone home, a really good friend of mine and myself, we would stay out almost half the night. We played 1-on-1 to 100, you know. And that was just the routine, not knowing what we were doing, but that was just the routine. And so that's how, you know, I enjoyed the playground and how the playground helped me. And I think that at that time I became a student of the game, and that's why I would work by myself. I mean, I would work on specific things, not knowing what I was doing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So that was my follow-up question, is when you said not knowing what you're doing, yeah, and you were working by yourself, how did you come up with, or how did you figure out, or how did you think about what you wanted to do? And I'll give you an example from my own life. Yeah. So when I was going through, from the time I was in high school all the way through college, I had two workouts. I had one workout that I would do by myself, where I would go through the same series of shots, the same series of moves. And I did that for probably 7 years. And then I had another workout that I would do if I could get somebody who was willing to either rebound for me or wanted to shoot with me. So I had those two workouts. And now you think about, as a player development coach, the resources that are out there and the things that you can do, from film study just to all just copying off what other people are doing, the resources that are available to players and coaches today compared to when you were a kid or when I was a kid just weren't there. So how'd you figure out what to do, or what were you doing while you were on the court by yourself?
But, you know, I just had an instinct to really work on my ball handling a lot, because I was growing fast, and I didn't want to limit myself to just, and at this time, I didn't want to limit, or I should say at that time, I did not want to limit myself to just having to play with my back to the basket, because I was pretty agile as a player. So I would work on my ball handling a lot, and I would work on my shooting a lot, and I would work on my rebounding a lot. And so, as far as how creative I got and things that I created for myself, I'll give an example in the rebound department. I would stand at about the free throw line area with my back to the basket and bounce it real hard where it hits the backboard, and then turn and pursue it, you know, go as high as I can, you know, catch it and come down, chin it, you know, and then power dribble to half court. I don't know where I got that from, but it ended up being valuable for me.
Absolutely. That necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Right.
That's very cool. Very cool. All right. So as a high school player, what's one of your favorite memories from the time when you played high school basketball?
Well, you know, when I was in high school, I averaged like 19 points in my senior year, like 19 points and 19 rebounds per game. And my team at that time, we fell just short of becoming a city championship team. In fact, the first year I left, they won it all. So, you know, as far as winning championships, I had no great memories, but I had great teammates that really dominate my memories. And one of the greatest players that I looked to up to. Well, he is now Dr. Archie Mays. It was Archie Mays. Boy, he was really a good player. He was super smart, you know, in his classes, and that influenced me a lot. And his basketball game was just so disciplined and so intelligent, and that influenced me a lot. And so my memories of my high school memories are actually Archie Mays and wanting to perform like him. And that carried me through college because it was like he was a pro at that time, you know. So, but as far as games, man, we had some pretty outstanding Dayton basketball, high school basketball then and now. It was very competitive, and our games against the school that used to be called Colonel White, a school down the street from our school, was a rival game, and just crazy. You know, the leading scorer from that team at that time is my best friend at this time, and we were at different schools.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It was just a lot of great players. As I mentioned, I didn't really grow up in Dayton, so I was kind of like the new guy here, and I didn't grow up through the different programs that they might have had for the kids. You kind of knew you were going to grow up and become a surefire player. You know, I was just the guy trying to get in where I fit in.
So as you go through your high school career in Dayton, at what point do you start to feel like you're going to have an opportunity to play beyond high school and maybe get an opportunity to play college basketball? When did that thought first strike you? Was it always something that was on your mind? Just talk to me a little bit about your process for recruiting and going to college to play basketball.
Well, you know, I mentioned a little earlier that in the 10th grade, when I moved here, I started setting goals. And it was in the 10th grade that my goal, you know, I want to make all city. I want to get a basketball scholarship. So it was a goal. And so it became, but I realized in my junior year that it was a reality that I could achieve, you know, these goals. And so I just kept, you know, with the work, I stayed focused on my goals. That was my main focus, was always to remain focused. And I've always been that way. Just some of the other older players, I would play with older players because I always wanted to be around the best. You know, for example, when I was at that age in the 10th and 11th grade, I would go up to the University of Dayton and I would rebound for Johnny Davis, you know, when he was at UD. I would just rebound for him. You know, he would be getting his shots off and I rebound the misses. I'm working on my rebound and outlet it back to him. I've always been focused on rebounding. But just the way that those guys worked Johnny Davis, again, some of the things he impressed upon me was, I mean, he was a guy, he'd come in the gym and his shirt would be tucked in. He would always be neat, you know, presentable. And so that's how I became, my shirt tucked in, you know, because I liked that and I liked what he was doing, you know. So it was my junior year that I really felt like I had a chance because I started getting letters, you know, started getting letters from schools. Started getting on people's radar, you know, and then of course in my senior year, it kind of started blowing up a little bit.
Do you remember who your first letter was from?
Oh wow, no, I don't think I remember who the first one. I remember when I started getting shot. When I got letters from Princeton and Yale. I'm like, wait a minute. That doesn't really fit me, but okay, thanks.
All right, well, hey, no, stop for a second. So if you're getting letters from Princeton and Yale, now you may be downplaying this, but I got to believe that you were at least a pretty good student if you're getting letters from Princeton and Yale.
Well, you know, that's why it was surprising for me. You know, no, I wasn't the best student coming up. I maintained I was eligible, you know. And I think that might have been part due to, you know, moving and how, you know, the hours and everything are the courses that I took as a freshman growing up in California, then coming to Dayton, and everything was just so different. And it actually kind of, as far as my books were, it kind of set me back just a little bit. But, you know, I built myself up where I was, you know, more than able to, you know, receive a Division I scholarship, which is what I ultimately did. But as far as Yale, those schools, I wasn't that type of a student. I guess they thought I was that type of a basketball player. And who knows, if I would have accepted a scholarship to one of the schools, I probably would have been that type of student.
All right. So describe the process of how you went about making your decision, how you end up going to Southern University. Just tell us a little bit about your thought process and what that recruiting was like for you.
Yeah, it was pretty great. You know, it kind of started, just to kind of give you the whole story of how Southern University happened, is that the coach Carl Stewart, just a brilliant man. You know, he happened to be at my high school, and I saw him kind of walk. I was in my locker. I saw him walking through the halls with the guidance counselor and the principal, and as it turns out, as he passed me, he was wondering, well, who is he? And they said, well, that's Lionel Garrett, this, that, and the other. Now, Coach Stewart was accidentally at my high school. He was going to Colonel White High School, which is down the street from my high school, to see a phenomenal player, to talk to him, named Robert Patterson, averaging 35 points a game in high school. But he ended up in the wrong gym. wrong school. He ended up in the wrong school. And so, of course, the principal and guidance, they got me out of class to come and sit down and talk to Coach Stewart, you know. And we had a good conversation. And I mentioned to him in that conversation Frankie Sanders. And Frankie Sanders was playing in the state championship down in Columbus the next night. And so I mentioned that to him. And so he ended up going there, you know. So he invited me to come and visit the school. And, you know, we planned that out. In the meantime, Frankie Sanders and I don't know if you're familiar with Frankie, but he's probably one of the greatest players out of Dayton. We were visiting, ended up at the airport, going to the same schools, including Southern. And so Coach Stewart was such a brilliant, precise, his recruiting job was so precise with me, you know, from the moment that we met, you know, he was totally prepared. He was able to talk to me about the school and show me the school. And then I realized that it was a historically Black college, university. And I didn't know much about Black schools. Then I grew up in California. There weren't any out there. And, you know, as I moved to Ohio, there are not many here, you know. So I wasn't really familiar with that at all. But I was like, but it looks beautiful. And so, you know, so that was an education for me in itself. And so when we went through the process, and I say we for a reason, because it was three of us. It was Robert Patterson at Colonel White, who we originally, you know, came into the area to see, myself and Frankie Sanders. So we go down there, and Coach Stewart just has everything so nicely, nothing illegal, just everything straight, reality. And, you know, he had a party set up for us. He had all these things. He had a banquet set up for us, all these things. Now, in the meantime, I was recruited by other schools. I was recruited by University of Dayton. I had interest in, I think it was Michigan State had interest in me. Dayton really wanted me to set me up to go to Vincennes Junior College. At that time, they had the number one junior college program in the nation, you know, and then to Dayton. And in Michigan, we had a couple of conversations, but it just kind of faded away. But, you know, the media people here and everybody here in Dayton at that time felt like the three of us would be a player that would end up at a major Division I school, just like we figured. I go down to Southern University, and it's just beautiful, beautiful campus. It's in the SWAC. In fact, the SWAC at that time had upgraded to NCAA Division I. However, my freshman year, the entire SWAC, that's the Southwest Athletic Conference, was on probation, so we were not eligible for postseason play until after I left. But we still were Division I, you know, so we turned into an NCAA Division I school. We had a brand new arena that was built that we opened up that is just beautiful to this day. And, you know, I mean, the girls were really pretty.
<You know? laughs> That never hurts anything.
Yeah. Just be honest with you. And I decided on the flight back that I think I'm going to go to Southern, you know. And so Frankie is like, well, we've been visiting these schools together, so if you go, I'm going. And of course, Robert Patterson said, well, y'all can't leave me out. I'm going to go as well. So when that hits the media, they think that we have lost our minds. Wait a minute. What is this? What is this place? You know, and but I can say this just to speed it up to this day. I mean, as recently as this week, there's been a lot of conversation about the teams that we played on. We went down there and we made history, you know, and, you know, we were drafted and every one of our teammates got drafted to the NBA. We did not get buried, you know, doing that. And we became, you know, we went down there and we became legends, and it turned out to be just an unbelievable experience, very different. But that's how I got to Southern, though, you know. I fell in love with it.
I want to jump in real quick. I want your take on, you're talking about recently, the whole maker, he's going to, where's right. he going? Like,
he's
is that what you're
Hampton.
Yeah,
he's going to Hampton.
So do you think this is going to, you know, maybe turn the tide on some of these things where players start looking at other colleges instead of Duke, Kansas, and look at these historically black colleges, or like, what's your take?
Yeah, well, I don't mean to be biased, but I not only, you know, did I attend an HBCU, now coached at three HBCUs. All of my college coaching has been, and it not by design, just the way it unfolded for me. So I love my HBCUs, and I'm happy that the big guy decided, you know, that a five-star player decided to attend an HBCU. And I think that it is going to kind of trend. You're going to see more players doing that. And I think it's just the environment that we're living in right now. And, you know, there's been a certain kind of pride about the growth and development and the needs of historically black colleges, universities. So some of these young guys who are considering HBCUs, it's because they want to help. They know that if a couple of really five-star players are playing on Hampton, for example, they're going to get TV rights. They're going to generate revenue for the school, and that's going to help the school build its profile and create more revenue for itself. And I think that those are the kind of thoughts that some of these young men are having. So, you know, I don't know if it's going to blow up, but it definitely is going to be a trend. It's going to be happening right now.
Well, I think it's one thing that if you went back 15 or 20 years ago, I don't think that anybody would have foreseen that a player of that caliber would choose a historically black college. It just wasn't something that was on. It was just something that was on the radar. And so the fact that that is happening, I think it speaks to, again, kind of where we are as a country right now and the all the things that are going on. I think this is probably, I want to interrupt our college talk and I want to come back to it, but I think this is a great time to ask you about what's going on in our country right now in the moment and what you can do or what coaches can do to impact and have discussions with the young people that are underneath their charge. What are some things that maybe are conversations that you're having with the young people that you're in contact with in terms of giving them things that they can do? How can they take action to be able to support the Black Lives Matter movement, to be able to support some of the things that are going on in our country to make meaningful change? Because I think that's one of the things that Jason and I have talked about it ourselves. We've talked about it with several guests on the show, and we're trying to figure out what are things that can actually be done. What are actions that people can take? What are you talking to your players about?
You know, my conversation never really changed because of, you know, Black Lives Matter as far as what I talk to about my players, because it's always the same. And the main thing that I really try to get these young men and young women to understand is respect, how to respect yourself and respect others. You know, so that's my basis. And that's, you know, respect, not just on the basketball court, but respect your teachers, respect your parents, respect your friends, treat people the way that you would want to be treated, and always, you know, try to talk to them about the way how I grew up. And, you know, I was a yes, sir, yes, ma'am kind of kid, you know, just have really good manners and how to dream and how to believe in yourself. those are always my main topics, and they're still my main topics. But what kind of, I grew up in California, as I mentioned, and I didn't even know anything about a black college. You know, I grew up because my father's in the Air Force in a totally diverse environment. And I was blessed that when I moved to Dayton, the high school that I ended up attending was a totally diverse school, you know. So what I'm encouraged to see right now during this Black Lives Matter thing, it seems like a little undercurrent of a change, an undercurrent, people kind of listening to what some of us African Americans are saying, you know. And when I see white kids out there protesting hard about Black Lives Matter, I realize that this generation is tired of this, you know, and that that is the thing that encouraged me so much about it, that it became a diverse situation, not just, you know, anger, you know, of a people who, you know, are continuing to be oppressed. It's like everybody is tired of it now. And that's what impressed me the most about it. But I think that the best way, though, to deal with, or one of the best ways to deal with these young people, is just to treat them with respect, you know, and continue to encourage them to, you know, to live their life with respect and continue to dream and continue to move forward. I think that this thing is so fluid. We just kind of have to roll with it right now and see, you know, where it's going to take us. And so I hope that it kind of takes us where, you know, the world is better. And that's kind of what I see. And that's the whole point.
I agree. I think one of the most encouraging parts of it is what you mentioned, in that when you look at the protests, especially the peaceful protests that have gone on all over the place, and you look at those and you look at the diversity of the people who are in those crowds, and that's something that is completely encouraging. And then on a personal level, for me, one of the things that I think that this has brought to light for myself is it just makes you think about some of the things as a white American that you may not have thought of before. You may not have put yourself into a position where you have to think about, if I was in this exact same situation and I was African American, how would I maybe look at that differently? And I think when you start to do that and you start to put yourself into somebody else's shoes, it makes it easier for you to develop the empathy and understanding for their perspective and for what is happening to them, around them, and just the way that the perception can be different. And to me, that's been incredibly powerful just for me as an individual. And then the last thing that I wanted to ask you, and I heard you say it a couple times, but I just want to kind of clarify, and that is, when you talked about yourself growing up as a respectful person with manners and all those types of things, and you're dealing with your young players, the people that you come in contact with day in and day out, how important do you feel being a role model and your actions are when people are seeing you, when your players are seeing you interact with others in a respectful manner versus you just talking to them about it? How important are your actions as far as the influence that you have on your players?
Well, you know, the first thing that we have to do just fundamentally is earn each other's respect and trust. And so if I'm talking one game and I'm and then someone sees me doing another thing, then I'm not earning your trust. So that's the most important thing to me, is to earn trust. And so I carry myself off the court where I walk it like I talk it, you know, and that's the most important thing, because if I can't earn your trust, we can't be good friends. Or I can't be a good coach to you, and we're going to just end up in a cycle of mistrust and never get to the point where we know how to improve and get better on and off the court. So that's the most important thing to me, is how I carry myself around my players, how I present myself. Just the same way, watching Johnny Davis as a kid, keep his shirt tucked in, the same thing, except from a grown up now, you know, and so my actions, my movements, how I talk, actually a coach, I, you know, well, I guess I should say I rarely use profanity.
That's a good qualifier. I like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, because, you know, something might slip out every now and then, but it's not even that bad. I try not to at all. I happen to be working for a team that didn't agree with that, and so it was really funny. If anybody heard me just use like a word, like, well, damn, just that simple, they'll look like, uh-oh, something's wrong.
Oh, yeah, he's really mad now. He's really taking it serious.
Yeah, and I purposely try to carry myself that way. And like I said, I have to walk it like I talk it. But those things are never, I don't think about it. Those are just instinctive things for me to do.
Absolutely. All right. Jason, thanks for jumping in with that question. It was a great question. And I think it led us to an area that we wanted to hit on at some point anyway, but that was a really poignant question right at that particular moment. So let's jump back, Lionel, to Southern. Talk to me a little bit about the transition, both from a social and academic standpoint, but also a basketball standpoint when you go from high school to Southern. What was that transition like for you from high school to college?
Right. Yeah. Well, the first thing that happened is I just fell in love with Louisiana. Southern University is in Baton Rouge. And it just felt like an entirely different world at that time, you know, because there were Creole people, you know, the gumbo, you know, the music, and literally the girls were beautiful. You know, so that transition was really solid. Being there with Frankie and Robert Patterson and then merging with our teammates, we just all just instantly developed, you know, tightness with each other. So, you know, we worked out hard in the off season. We did everything together. And so that transition was pretty smooth. So my transition was really good. As a freshman, I came in and I earned a starting spot, you know, on the varsity team. And I've been a starter ever since my freshman year. And the players that I was able to beat out and do that, they were really outstanding players, outstanding people, have been longtime coaches right now, you know, and we remain strong friends, because we all just respected each other, our abilities, and it was really something to behold, the way that we all went after it. My memories were really, really, the transition was really good. The things that I did best really fit in with the team. We had a team at Southern where, I played with one, two, maybe three different guys that led the nation in scoring. We were a run and stun team. We averaged like over 100 points a game. Okay. And so everybody in my start lineup averaged point wise in double figures, including I averaged 16, and I was, you know, I was the lowest average on the team as far as points.
They were drawing up plays for you. They said, go get it off the glass, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what I did. And it was important for a running team. And so I really, you know, what I did best really fit well with this team that we were putting together, because I get it off the board and outlet it, and we're off and running. Our coach used to just say, get out. And that's what that meant. And even if I rebounded the ball and outletted the ball, I had to be past half court by the time we got a layup. And a layup was, at that time, you didn't have three-pointers either. So a layup, Coach Stewart considered a layup a 30-footer. He just called them long layups. But whatever the case is, if I'm the outlet man, I had to get out there and run my butt down the court as fast as I can as well, because he wanted us to transition into office and get past half court within 3 seconds. And that was just all we were trying to do. So because the things that I love doing playing basketball found a home in a role, which gave me an understanding of my role as a rebounder. That's where my nickname, Rebound Doctor, came from. That's when I became the Rebound Doctor.
That's a good nickname. I like it a lot. All right. So I asked you this question about your high school career, and I'm guessing that one of your answers for this question is going to be the same when I ask you about what are some of the things, your maybe your best memory from college. I'm guessing your teammates is going to be one of those things. But can you pick out a moment, a game, something that stands out to you about your college career out on the floor?
There happens to be a game to a loss. And in fact, no, I'm sorry. My last regular season home game will never leave my memory because it was the end. Coming to my last, you know, it's over. The last game before our tournament, right? And so, as the game was beginning, I walked by our sports information table and I knocked on the table three times and I said, 30-30, like that. So this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to go out in my last regular season college game, right? And so that was my goal. Well, at the end of the game, I had 29-29 at 29 points and 29 and 29 rebounds. I argued. I said, I know I had 30 rebounds. and I will never forget that because I predicted that we won. And, you know, the seniors were all elated and happy. And then that led to my next memory, which was our tournament. You, of course, were in the tournament where the number one team entered into the tournament and we lose by two. And I just had an MVP type tournament. And because we lost, Larry Smith, who played in the NBA, played at Alcorn, who played in the NBA with Golden State and different teams for a very long time. He was awarded MVP. And so that's my other, I'm like, I could have got it if we just would have won by one.
Yep.
You know,
it's amazing how those little turns
right.
that you go back and you think about just, if this one thing didn't happen, we could have gone to this point, or we could have won this game, or maybe this opportunity would have materialized.
And that's what I tell my teams, one. I'm always just one. Although, you know, it has typically been through some of my teams I've coached a lot more than one.
That's true. I can get that. You can get into that too, no question about it. But sometimes it is just one, and it's definitely a good philosophy to go with, that one possession and one play can make all the difference. Even if that one play is in the first half of the first quarter, it can make a huge, huge difference. So as you finish up at Southern, are you thinking about at that point playing professional basketball? Obviously you get drafted into the NBA. What are you thinking about in terms of your chances to do that? How motivated are you at that point to make that happen? Just tell me what your mindset was as you're finishing up at Southern.
Well, I'll tell you, when I, you know, was finished with high school, I met an agent and we talked on the surface, him, myself, and Frankie. And one of the things that he told me was that if you are able to go to college and lead the nation in rebounding or something like that, I don't care what school you're at. I don't care if you're at Southern, wherever you are. And I think that you're going to be able to do that. If you do that, you're going to be in the NBA like that. So I was motivated when I was a freshman when I went there.
That's all you needed, right? Just somebody to believe in.
Let me get all these rebounds then, you know? And well, you know, he was right. And in fact, he was so right, of course, with Frankie. You know, we both, my entire starting five, you know, in my junior year, because three of those guys left in, we were all drafted by NBA teams. And this is in 78, 79 in the Deep South. And so one of the things that was happening in our practice, we were so talented that scouts were coming to our practice at an HBCU. At that time, we just made that much noise, you know. And then after there were three more of my teammates that I played with that I started with at one time for my 4 years there that were drafted into the NBA as well. So what that is, though, and this is a shout out for Southern University basketball, that was a record. There's no other HBCU that has ever done that, had eight players from the same team drafted into the NBA. And that's our claim to fame. And people still love us because we were so exciting. So when I arrived as a freshman you know, my mind and everybody else's mind. You know, when I think back, you know, and I had to go back to school to pick up different hours and different things because I was so focused on basketball, and no one even at that time was like, well, son, you just really need to focus more on this department. Everybody just knew that we were going to the NBA. It's the craziest thing, you know. So from the moment I arrived, I felt that way. It became my next goal. It was all, you know, you're a kid. You always think you can play in the NBA. But when people start telling you that, like power people start telling you that, if you put this work in, then these are the possibilities. And so that's why we never felt buried or anything, you know, by going to Southern.
All right. So tell us about what happens as you get drafted and then just go through your experience. You're mm-hmm. drafted by the Clippers. Just tell us what it was all about. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. Wow. That was, first of all, I wanted to get back to California and I get drafted by a California team. I'm like, oh God, it's wonderful. You know, and San Diego was so beautiful. And Gene Shue was the coach at that time. And he brought me, they didn't have the summer league stuff, but he brought me out early and I gained a lot of confidence, you know, playing against the guys on the teammate, you know, like at that time, the teammates were like Randy Smith, Lloyd Free, Bill Walton, Kevin Kuhnert, you know, and guys like that. And so I really, you know, that really kind of helped me. It helped me so much that of all of the draft picks and the free agents, I was the last one standing, so to speak. You know, I signed a contract with the Clippers and it was just really a amazing, like a dream come true. Being able to work with those guys, like I said, you know, the most amazing thing was when I was released because I really, the way that it happened, I was playing well and I was, you know, getting some good media, you know, the local media was, you know, doing a couple little stories about me or mentioning me, you know, and it felt like that I probably was surefire I was going to be that rookie on that team, you know, but when Bill Walton at that time, he was traded to San Diego. San Diego was his home. He was traded to San Diego and the trade, Kevin Kuhnert, one of their big power forwards, and Kermit Washington, they had to go to Portland in the trade. So Gene looked at me for as long as he could look, but he knew that Bill needed some help, some extra help, because at that time, Bill had some really bad foot problems as well. And so he traded for Joe Bryant, which is Kobe's dad, and Marvin Barnes, who was legendary, Marvin Barnes.
Marvin Bad News Barnes.
Yeah, that guy. Because those guys had played for Gene Shue, who was the coach at that time, and they had coached him in Philly. So when he made that trade, then that kind of asked me out, you know, and the business of the game came in. And so typically when a cut was going to come, you know, you knew, everybody knew, okay, at the end of the day, we're going to have to get rid of a couple players today. Nothing like that was said. In fact, I was between two a days and I was in the gym early, you know, shooting free throws. Trainer runs by me and says, hey, Lionel, Gene wants to see you in the office. I'm thinking Gene Shue, coach is about to tell me, well, son, there's some things you're going to have to work on, but we're just going to help you learn that stuff this year. Relax and play ball. You're a Clipper. I'm thinking I'm about to get that speech, but it wasn't really that speech. And the reason why he pulled the trigger on me and what was amazing, he said, well, he told me that he's going to have to let me go today. And then the rest of the conversation, the one thing he said was, but don't worry about it. You have a job. You're going to have a job. I didn't know what he was talking about. You know, I just wanted to get home. I was heartbroken. And fly home, and my father picks me up at the airport, and he says, you need to call your coach, you know, right now. So I stop at the payphone, call my coach, and he's like, your agent is looking all over the place for you, because I didn't talk to anybody. I just wanted to get that long ride back to Ohio out the way. And so I call my agent, Ron, and he's like, what are you doing? Why are you in Dayton right now? So I just wanted to come home. You already know that they released me. He's like, but I haven't been able to reach you. We didn't have cell phones. So I haven't been able to reach you because I got out of the hotel, you know.
Isn't that weird? So there was actually a time when you couldn't find somebody. It's amazing.
Yeah, you had to go to a payphone.
Right.
You
know?
Yeah. It's crazy now. It's unthinkable now. But the bottom line is, though, I had to turn right around when I arrived at Dayton from San Diego and turn right around and fly back to Los Angeles because the Harlem Globetrotters want you, and that's why the Clippers let you go so that you can join them, because they probably are not going to keep you beyond the trade deadline. So I'm like, what? Like, man, I don't know anything about spinning a basketball on my head, you know. just find me something in Europe or something. Like, are you crazy? Come on, because I'm very competitive. He's like, well, Lionel, this is all I can tell you right now. That the Globetrotters are going to match the contract that you had with the Clippers. They're going to match it, you know. And they don't want you to spin the ball on there. Everybody has roles. They want you to rebound for them. Because when the ball hits the rim, anybody can get that. And in order for the show to go on, we got to have the ball, you know. And so he said, you know, hey, you'll be home in December for 10 days, and we'll see what happens at that point. And so I flew out to Los Angeles, and then I became a Globetrotter. That's how that transition happened
within like 24 hours. You went from, right, I don't know anything about the Globetrotters, to, right, I am a Globetrotter.
Right, right, right. And I get to the camp, and this is kind of transitioning into another part of my basketball playing days. And so when I get to the camp, though, we didn't do a single, we call it rings, a single trip. We just had 2 days. We were just playing. We were just hooping. And in fact, they were looking for 5 guys. That was the other, they just, you know, so I had to go through the process to prove that I was worthy, and probably had about 50 or 60 guys out there who had just come from NBA camps, you know, and out in Hollywood, which was our home base. And well, fortunately for me at that time, I became 6 of the new players. I was one of 6, or was it 5 or something like that? New players that were able. And next thing I know, I'm being interviewed by Brian Gumbo, and, you know, and we're off and running. I'm still trying to figure out, well, what am I going to do? I don't know how to spin a ball in my head, you know. I don't do that kind of stuff, and because we didn't even work on it. And we get on the road for the first game. And so at the end of the first quarter, the player coach, he tell me, young fella, you go in. I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? He said, just go play. Get all the rebounds. Just go play. Play with enthusiasm. Do what you do. Put your personality on people. So I said, okay, that's simple enough. So I did that. And then it was halftime. And then when the third quarter came, and he told me at halftime, you're gonna start the second half in the third quarter. It's going to be yours. The second and third quarter are your quarters, you know. He said, now we're going to do, this is how I learned. Now we're going to do a little play. It's called Dipsy Do. And he described it to me where the guys are weaving and then cutting to the basket and faking a layup and tossing the air. The second guy falls and tosses it in the air. The third guy out of the weave tosses it. And then I just appear from any place and dunk it home. And the quarter ends at the end of that quarter. And that was me. That's what I did. And I did that for every single night, you know, and it's probably why my knees hurt today.
All right. So I want to talk to you about 2 things related to the Globetrotters. Let's start out with the travel first.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the places that you were able to go, and maybe 1 or 2 of the favorite cities, countries that you got a chance to visit as a result of your affiliation with the Globetrotters.
Yeah, yeah. Our travel was really intense. We were on the road for 6-7 months, and we played every single night and would have 1 night off a week. I played with the National. The Globetrotters divided into 2 units, the National unit and the International unit. I played with the National unit. It was just more popular because they had players like, God rest his soul at this point, Curly Neal. It was a unit that had Metalark Lemon, but I didn't play with him. He left the team the year before I joined the team. But it was the more popular team. So the National unit, we covered all the major cities in North America and Europe. So, I mean, where have I not been? It was so intense. But, you know, as it turns out, I had several favorite places. And I guess because they spoke English, and I was able to generate so many friends, London was my town. And it might also be the fact that when we would travel to Europe, we would go to London first, and we would stay in London for a month. So I felt like I lived in London. We would stay in London for a month, and we would, you know, travel out from there and play, but always come back to London, you know. And so I was able to, you know, the basketball was different, you know, because it was, you know, British people. It's not that like basketball was a big thing to them. Even with that said, though, they will start whistling if we did too many trick plays. They wanted us to be play basketball. And so they, you know, so it was kind of strange like that. And we played at Wembley Arena, our stadium or whatever they call it, at Wembley. And I just met so many wonderful people while I was in London. And notable people that I recall and just had a wonderful time as a young man. And in my international life, I'm hanging out with rock stars. I'm hanging out with bass player of the Rolling Stones. And we became fast, great friends that quick. And we met. One of the things I did with the Globetrotters is I would do some of our advanced stuff. I would do radio. And so while in London, I was scheduled to do a BBC radio show. So I arrived at the studio and Bill Wyman, who played bass for the Rolling Stones, he's there too. So now we're both on this call-in talk show, and he's a Rolling Stone, and London is his home. And he's in town to promote the soundtrack or the music, or the soundtrack of a movie, you know, that was coming out at that time that he wrote. And I'm there with the Globetrotters. So it's like, how is this going to work? You know, and it worked out unbelievably great. People were posing questions to both of us. His girlfriend, she brings a bottle of wine in and puts it in the middle of the table where we sit. And Bill looks at me and said, would you like a glass? And me being friendly, I'm like, sure. and so when we were finished and it was over, he invited me. He said, I'm going to be in town for the rest of the week, and I have a lot of different functions happening in the evening. What time do you get back to your hotel? And I told him, he said, I'm going to invite you to everything. I'll have a car come and pick you up. So I hung out with him for a week and just had the greatest time. You know, he had large dinners and parties, and I met so many different people off of that, spun off like Stephen Stills, cats like that. And so what ended up happening, I would really get into every city, you know. I would walk around, I would get to meet the people, but that experience in London, it just helped, you know, it was a different level of meeting different people and getting involved with different things. And so that's why that's my strongest memory, and I have the most stories of, which I can't tell you all stories.
were you a big music guy? Yes.
I knew Stephen Stills, and the reason why, you know, I ended up, I met him at one of the dinners, and we were sitting near each other, and we were talking about music. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I like jazz. I really like jazz at that time. He said, I do too. And I said, oh, do you really? He's like, yeah. He said, I got a couple tracks that you need to hear. So he was just in London because I think he was dealing with some kind of lawsuit. and he had a large suite, his hotel. And he had all of his equipment set up in there. You would think it was a studio. So on the way in, jumped in the taxi with him, stopped by his place and by his hotel, and he played the music for me. And, you know, so I became a critic. It was really nice. I was so surprised that Stephen Stills played jazz. Cool, you know. And so, yes, I was then and I am now. Music has always been the soundtrack.
All right. Second thing I wanted to ask you about was the personalities of some of the more well-known guys that you have to play with. I will admit to frequently running around my gym as a young kid, trying to slide on my knees like your teammate Curly Neal.
Hey, Curly.
So yeah. Talk to me a little bit about what kind of guy Curly Neal was, because he's obviously a famous name, and especially from somebody who is my age. So I just turned 50 this year. So okay. Curly was kind of in the heyday of when I was a kid. So just tell me a little bit about him. I'm curious what kind of guy he was as a teammate.
Oh, Curly was the best, man. He really was. You know, Curly, most of my teammates, we'll stick with Curly right now. You know, I was really close to Curly. In fact, I would shave the back of his head for him because he would shave. he would shave his head before games, you know, to make sure it's nice and clean. And back in those days, I have a bald head. Back in those days, it was like, you know, all you had was like people like Kelly Savalas.
Right. There you go.
You know, with the bald head. It wasn't, you know, that big until Michael Jordan kind of brought it into being cool. It was funny with Curly. So he would put a curly wig on, you know, and then as we were being introduced, you know, it would get snatched off and then, you know, and then he has a bald head. And so people like hee hee ha, you know, they loved it for some, well, I'm not going to say that. They loved it. But every night, you know, they call me Doc. My teammates with the Chargers call me Doc. So you go Curly, Doc. I call Curly Bone because of his head. He's like, Doc, get the back for me. And so I realized that every night before the game, I'm shaving the back of his head. You know, as with Curly, though, just a sweet human being, man. You know, he was an unbelievable basketball player as well. But his personality and persona just found its way to be a Globetrotter for life, you know. And we were considered with the Globetrotters, we are goodwill ambassadors and we represented the United States in that way. And he was the best. He was the best goodwill ambassador that you could ever imagine. Super talented, you know, unbelievable personality. He had patience with everybody because, I mean, people, this is one of the things I discovered about the Trotters. You know, we're playing in Indianapolis, to give you an example. And the 76ers are playing in Indianapolis the next night or something like that. So we're both in the same hotel. And this is when Dr. J was with Philly then. This was at that time. So our hotel lobby is full. And then I realized that those people in the lobby are not here to really see the Philadelphia players. They're looking for us.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. You know, And that was because of guys like Curly, his personality. He'd come down there and drink a cup of coffee and talk to everybody and sign autographs. You know, nothing was ever too much for him. You know, he taught me about the road, how to live on the road, you know, simple things about how to keep your clothes not wrinkled, you know, living out of a suitcase for 6-7 months, you know. And so I was so saddened this year, you know, by the loss of him, you know, he just seemed like somebody that would live forever. You know, his personality was that big and that sweet. He was a fantastic human being.
So to go along with that, I think when I think back to that heyday of the Globetrotters and Saturday afternoon, Wide World of Sports and Jim McKay and talking about here come the Globetrotters, and you think about those guys. And I remember, you know, they clearly, just like you said, the Globetrotters, it's hard for somebody probably even who's Jason's age to relate to the fact that the Globetrotters at that time were such a huge, huge deal and were really a cultural phenomenon. But I think one of the questions that I used to have or used to think about, especially with a guy like Curly Neal, who clearly had a tremendous amount of basketball skill, is – what kind of player could he have been had he played in the NBA? So what's your thought, the guys that played with you, your teammates, and obviously you were close and I'm sure you could have gotten another opportunity and made it in the right situation. But when you look at some of the guys that you played with, who were maybe a name or two that you think, oh, no doubt had this guy been in the NBA, they would have been a really good player?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Several of us. One named Billy Ray Hobby. I mean, Billy Ray played at Dillard University, 6'8 guard. Unbelievable. He certainly should have played in the NBA. But his personality was so dynamic, and he found his niche with the Globetrotters that he made it, what did he play, about 18 years with the Globetrotters. And so sometimes, even like with a guy like Curly, that became his decision. I don't want to play in the NBA. I'm fine where I am.
Right.
You know, I was the only one that didn't want to play with the Globetrotters. I was the only one. And I did, you know, break away after 3 or 4 years. And I went and started playing professionally in Spain. And that's how I branched into Spain and got away from them. Billy Ray, Robert, big baby face Page, 7-footer that just could do everything, you know, had the prettiest hook shot, the prettiest, just great size, NBA body, you know. He could have easily been a really good NBA player. So when I first started playing and the player coach put me in the game in the second quarter, and he said, just do what you do and play with enthusiasm. What he was telling me was go out there and hoop, because that was also, especially at that time, an element of the Charters. While we did all these other things, you know, we also, they wanted people to know that we were really great players as well and did outstanding things. I turned rebounding into part of the game. Our announcer would keep stats, and he would, you know, I mean, I'm playing in the Globetrotter game, and he's keeping my stats, and I have 24 points and 27 rebounds. And so he's announcing it like he's trying to get me to the 30 rebounds. So now it's probably the show, you know. And then, but the dynamic of it is, which is so crazy. So I've had one of those type of nights, and we're signing autographs after the game, and, you know, the parents will look at me and be like, well, I don't remember seeing you out there. And I'm like, well, I don't remember seeing you either.
That's
you
know, funny.
I'm the one that just had about 30 rebounds tonight, but that's okay.
That's hilarious. So here's a question that I've always wanted to ask. You're traveling with the Washington Generals. How much contact do you have with those guys off the floor? And did you ever develop a relationship with anybody from the Generals during your time with the Trotters?
Absolutely. We traveled separately. We stayed in separate hotels. We would only see each other, you know, we arrived at the arena and play, and if we were going to get together after the game and do something. What some of those guys on the Washington Generals were doing, though, is they were trying to become Globetrotters, you know, and they had a lot of talent. And some of them did. And one of my best friends, Harold Hubbard, he did break through, and just an outstanding player. And we used to hang out, you know, there were him, Harold Hubbard, Mike Johnson. I don't know if you remember Eddie Johnson, that played with the Bulls.
And absolutely. Yep.
That's his brother. That's his brother. But Mike played with the Generals, and Mike was such a great player for the Generals that we called him Sideshow. and I still talk to those guys to this day.
That's very cool. So I'm going to tell my Globetrotter story. I don't know if I've ever told this story on the podcast.
Okay, you got one?
I got one. So when I was, I'm trying to think, this was probably, had to be shortly after I graduated from college. So I'm thinking it was probably somewhere in 1993, 1994, like that. A friend of mine calls me up and says, hey, Mike, they're having this radio station is having a contest. Okay. You have to go and try out. And if you go to this tryout and you get selected from the tryout, you will get an opportunity to suit up for the Washington Generals.
Oh, wow.
And get free tickets for, you got like 4 tickets or 5 tickets or something to go along with this. If you, if you went to this tryout and you were selected. So I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that. And my friend keeps trying to convince me that, come on, you should go. It should be, it'd be fun. And of course, like I told you before, growing up kind of in the heyday of the Globetrotters, eventually kind of wore me down. I'm like, all right, I'll go. So I go, and there's probably, I would guess there was probably 35 or so people there. And there were people of all different levels of basketball ability. Let's just put it that way. You had people doing cartwheels, and you had other people trying to show off their dribbling skills and whatever. And to be honest with you, I don't even remember what I did as my little 1 minute or 2 minute tryout or whatever we had to do. I think I just ended up taking shots and doing some things. But anyway, I got selected as the person that was going to get an opportunity to go and play.
Oh, cool.
The Generals. So the game was at the old Richfield Coliseum.
Uh-huh.
So I go out to the Coliseum. I get there early. I get introduced to, some members of the Generals. And we go out onto the floor. And they were going to put me in during the segment where the trotters are doing the weave, like you described with the dipsy do, where they're ducking in and out and the ball is flying around. And so the directions that they gave me, and they had me practicing, it was you have to stay right on the guy from the Globetrotters. You have to stay right on his tail, or you're going to get hit in the head by the ball. If you're not right on his, back, you're going to take one in the head. So I'm like, okay. Right. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to practice. I'm trying to do this, you know, whatever. And I'm like, all right, I got it. So we get to the game, and I can't remember, it was maybe the second or third quarter, you know, the thing's going to come on. And I go out on the floor, and, you know, after like, I don't know, 15 or 20 seconds, they, you know, it's time for my little, my part of the performance. So I'm trying to stay up. And of course, you're in the game and everything's moving a lot faster than it was in practice. And I'm running through and boom, I take one right in the head.
Right. Yeah, trying to tell you.
Yeah, they're like, you know, you got to stay right on. So took one in the head, but then they left me in. I got to play another minute or two. And at one point while I was in there, I got fouled. I don't know if I got fouled, but they called the foul, and I got to go to the free throw line in the game.
Uh-oh.
And I got to make two free. I made two free throws. I went two for two.
Okay, they let you shoot them. Good.
So yeah, they let me shoot them. So in my Washington Generals career, I was two for two at the line with one ball off the head, and it was just it was a really cool experience.
You were in the show.
That's right. Yeah. I was in the show.
I want you to know, Lionel, I have known Mike since I was 6 years old, and I've never heard this story. I'm 33 now, so 26, 27 years. I've never heard this story. This is the first time.
Well, Mike has vetted out for the world to know.
Everybody knows.
And listen, that's a great honor to get hit in the head by a ball.
It is, absolutely.
From the Globetrotters.
I wish there was, if it was nowadays, there definitely would be video.
There would definitely be video. Now, I will say, I do have a still photo or two of that, and Jason will appreciate this, and I'll have to break it out at some point. So earlier, probably, I don't know, this was maybe 4 months ago, 5 months ago, I can't remember. We did a podcast with the guys from Five Star Basketball. And in the course of that conversation, I said to them, I said, I have a bag of old like shirts and things that kind of are mementos of my career. And so I went, as we were doing the podcast, I went and got out my All-Star Game shirt from Five Star, and I put that thing back on, and I took a photo of myself, and I put it on social media. And I'll say to you and to Jason, I have the uniform of the Washington Generals that I wore that night. Now, this was back in 1992, 93, so I was only a year or two removed from being a college basketball player. And at that point, the uniform was ridiculously small on me. At that point. So right now, I haven't gotten this thing out in a long time, but I have a feeling it would look very, very ridiculous. So I am now motivated to, at some point, either tonight or tomorrow, I will go into my bag of uniforms and get it out and take a picture of it and put it on social media for people to see. I will not be wearing it because that could be rather embarrassing, but I will definitely take a photo.
Yeah, I can't wear mine either.
And I don't know if I could have even worn it back then. I don't know that it fit too well. So,
yeah, I look at stuff. I'm like, how did I wear that?
No doubt, exactly.
I mean, that's great. That's a great experience. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You mentioned Five Star. You were a Five Star player.
I was. So I went. I went to Five Star only 1 year. I went between my junior and senior year, and the year that I went, Billy Owens was the big name guy who was there the week that I was there. And I went with the idea that I was a really good high school player, but I was not, as we talked about off the top, where you suddenly discovered that you were able to jump out of the gym. I discovered that I was able to jump over a newspaper. So, so for me, I relied on some other things in order to get me where I wanted to go. So I guess my point is that I was not a big time recruit by any means, but I went to Five Star with the idea still that I was going to be recruited by all the big name schools. And I got there and nobody knew who I was. And I ended up not making it to the top league at Five Star. So I was in, I think the top league was the NBA, and the second league was the NCAA or however they had it set up. And so I remember all week playing with a chip on my shoulder, looking at these guys who are playing in the league above me and saying, oh, I'm as good as these guys. I'm as good as these guys.
Right.
And I ended up making, you know, making the All-Star team in the league. And then I ended up being,
and then I ended up being
the MVP of the All-Star game. So,
I felt like I
had proved myself, and I'm like, well, if I was the MVP of this All-Star game, I probably could have been playing in the top league. But five-star was a great experience for me. The learning that went on, just went along with, you know, everything that we talked about with playground basketball and playing outside. And that was my element. It was just, there was no place like Five Star, and I don't think there ever will be again.
Oh wow, that's fantastic. I didn't know MVP. Okay, congratulations.
thank you. As I tell my kids whenever they ask me something, I'm like, that was a long time ago.
Everything is a long time ago.
That's true. So, what's your experience with Five Star, Lionel?
I never went to a five-star.
Okay.
But those are the type of things that it wasn't AAU. It was those different kind of camps.
Yep.
The players would go to, be it local or whatever. And I never did any of that, you know, when I was in high school coming up.
And like I said, I only went 1 year. I mean, I know there were lots of people that either had a bigger reputation or had better connections to places and people that they went from the time that they were a freshman, and I just never had that opportunity. And really, I only got the opportunity because a guy who went to my high school, who was 4 years older than me, he had a connection to somebody who had a connection to somebody that ended up getting me in and getting his younger brother into the camp with me. And so the two of us went, and so it had nothing to do with my merits as a player that got me in there. It was just the fact that I knew somebody who knew somebody, and that's how I ended up getting an opportunity to go. But it's one of those experiences that when you look back on sort of the history of American basketball, the fact that I was able to spend a week there was tremendous for me. I mean, even just from a podcasting standpoint, the number of people that we've had on that have talked about the influence that Five Star had on them, whether it was as a player or guys who got to go there as a coach. It's just amazing. So I'm really thankful that I got an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I wish that I could have as well. But like I mentioned to you earlier, I didn't grow up in Dayton. I moved to Dayton in the 10th grade of high school. I just kind of jumped on the scene. So I'm really proud of what, you know, and of course, I'm a high school Hall of Famer from my school. In that short period of time, it amazes me from Fairview High School in Dayton. And I'm also at Southern University. I'm part of the athletic Hall of Fame.
That's awesome.
And we had a lot of legendary basketball players come out of Southern, such as Avery Johnson, names that you probably know, who, you know, just became a coach in the NBA, won championships with the Spurs, you know, and they did some great things. You know, he's a Southern University athletic Hall of Famer as well.
It's really cool to be able to have and feel a connection to the program that you went to and participated in. And that's, I think that there's always, even guys that you didn't play with, you have a bond with. And I know, like, since I graduated, obviously I'm in contact with many of my teammates, but also I've developed friendships with guys, mainly guys who actually played after I did, who are younger than me. I've had an opportunity to be able to get to know those guys and become friends with them. And it's just, you know, there's a bond there that when you go through that experience, that nobody who hasn't gone through it can really understand what that process is all about. So it definitely connects you.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's been forever since I've been away from college, and recently this week on my social network, somebody sent me a picture of the starting five. Like it was playing against Texas Southern, had all of us on it. And so I eventually posted it on my Facebook page, and it has been amazing. The people making comments, the people who were not teammates, you know, the people who enjoyed, you know, what we did, you know, the time that we were living in, sidebar conversations. It became like this big alumni thing, you know, and it was so beautiful. It's on my Facebook page right now. The conversation's been going on for the last week.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, you know, not, it's not just the players, you know, it's and then realize the impact. You know, we were college kids.
Right.
The impact we had on some of the other students, you know, who are now doctors and
right.
lawyers, but they remember, you know, trying to get to the gym before anybody else could get, so they wouldn't have to stand up, you know.
Yeah, and you may not have even known them at that point.
I didn't. I probably did not, you know. I it's so crazy, and this is happening now. This is happening today. You know, one of the he told me, I mean, not players, but one of the alumni, I guess I'll call him, told me that he was like a little kid, like 6, 7, 8 years old when I was playing there. But his parents used to talk about it all the time. He lived in Baton Rouge, you know. And I'm just like, yeah, this is really amazing. And so he knew about our team. He knew about it. So he asked me, you know, a few days ago, would I sign his basketball? So he's like in Baton Rouge and I'm here. So, you know, he's a doctor, you know? And so I'm like, yeah, I will. I'll let you know, you know, because I still go to Baton Rouge a lot. Let you know when I come back down there. He sends me a message today and says, I got my basketball. What's your address? Like, wow, man, really? Okay.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what we talked about earlier about what you do as a role model and how people exactly. see you. And you never know, as a coach, as an athlete, you never know who is watching you.
That's it right there.
Who you're making an impression on. And a lot of times, I think
that's
sometimes,
right there.
You know, sometimes we get caught up, you know, people get caught up in the moment and maybe behave in a way that maybe they wouldn't be proud of. And I think if you're intentional yeah. and you're conscious of what you're doing, yeah. then you end up being the type of role model that somebody like this situation that you just described, somebody who was 7 or 8 years old, you never met them, you never knew
right.
them, but yet yeah. for some reason right. you had an impact on that kid. And who yeah. knows, maybe you played some yeah. small part in making
that
good
wasn't
decision.
Even and that wasn't even with the Globetrotters. That's when I was a kid in college.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you just said something that's exactly, you never know was watching. So I spent a lot of time coaching and minor league basketball as well. And I coached, was commissioned, and kind of ran a league called the WBA that was based out of Atlanta. We had an unbelievable league. We put a lot of guys developed themselves and got to the NBA and became international superstars. One game, a name you may remember, I don't know, you may know, is Jamario Moon.
Yeah, absolutely. Played for the Cavs here.
Exactly. That was my guy. He can
jump out of the gym. Jump out of the gym, Jamario Moon.
Yeah, he played for me on several different teams in that league. Yeah, and he was like my son. He's at my house all the time cooking. You know, I knew him when he was broke. You know, but one of the things though that with those guys and including Jamario is that you never know who's watching you. But at that level, they're watching everything you do. Scouts are there. They're watching how you, if you're taken out of the game, how you walk to the bench, you know, where you sit and what's your attitude. They're watching how, you know, scouts are watching how NBA people are watching how, if you make a mistake, you know, do you take responsibility for your mistake or does your body language indicate that it was somebody else's fault, you know? So you never know who's watching you. And that was something that we used to stress all the time. Jamario was really interesting. Jamario was an unbelievable talent. Unbelievable talent, but nobody was interested in him because he is kind of aloof. He's very aloof. You know, he's from Goodwater, Alabama, a little country town. And Jamario would he wouldn't mind if I'm saying this about him because I tell him to his face all the time. He knows how he was. He would be just as happy if he was just sitting on his porch chewing on a blade of grass. That's just who he is.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to figure out, you know, I'm working with a team. We had a legendary team in the WBA called the Rome Gladiators. And I was associate head coach of that because the head coach, Harold Ellis, also worked with the Atlanta Hawks. Theo Ratliff, who at the time was playing in the NBA, Theo was our team owner. You know, we had a dynamic team. So we were bringing those kind of players in, like Jamario. So Jamario comes in. He's under my wing. So I'm trying to help him figure out how to get people, you know, to understand that he's a player that can play in the NBA. And luck will have it that happened. But the things, you know, I tried to help him he had a problem with perception, and perception is reality. So it was kind of like, well, how do we get you out of this reality? And so I suggested to him, we worked on it, and I got on him. If he didn't do some simple things like 50-50 ball, pursue it. Don't just stand there. Any 50-50 ball, I don't care where you are, run toward it. Just keep moving. Simple thing, you know. And, yeah. And Jamario, he had long arms, as you know, and he's really athletic and really mobile. I mean, Jamario's 6'8". So we worked harder on his perimeter defense because I want him to be able to get his hands on ball, deflections, and steals. And that's how he got into his high flight game. You get a steal or deflection, get in the lane and dunk it. And that's what he did, the things that he did the most. So we worked on that. And so Jamario, with my help, you know, he ends up moving from us. He needs more exposure, and he goes to the Albany Patroons in the CBA. And, you know, when that, our season was in the summertime, and it was there. He played with Michael Ray Richardson. Michael Ray Richardson just happened to be telling him the same things that I was telling him. It just seemed like the most logical things to help him with. And then the team in Toronto saw him, and they invited him to a camp. He got through the camp, made it with the Toronto Raptors, made the team. Oh, my God. He's a 28-year-old rookie. That's my guy. And then, of course, he got traded a couple of times, and one team being Cleveland.
Yep.
That's my guy. We talked to this guy. I think I talked to him a couple of days ago.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's just amazing stories like that when you hear about just the trials and tribulations and journeys that different players go on and different people have through the game of basketball. And yeah. It's endlessly fascinating to me the different ways that people have to interact with the game, both, you know, as players, as coaches, yeah. and just all the different places that you can play. And you know, some of the minor yeah. league basketball that you're talking about that many yeah. people who love basketball and who are immersed in basketball don't even know that some of those leagues and places have existed for years and years and years. And it's just,
yeah.
there's so
yeah.
many different ways that you can stay involved in the game and give back to it. And, you know, yeah. I think just from having this conversation, hopefully for our audience, it comes across loud and clear just how much you love the game and how much I love the game. And Jason, yeah. just the way that we feel about it, what it's given to us. And, you know, I think about pretty much everything in my life in some way, shape, or form. I can either trace back directly to basketball or trace back to a lesson that I learned from basketball that helped shape me into who I am today. And I think, you know, it's clear from talking to you that you feel the same way. I want to ask you, just talking about what you've, you know, where you've jumped to now is, when did you know that you wanted to coach? Was that something that while you were playing, you thought, hey, when I get done, I want to coach? Or was it more when your playing career ended, you looked around and said, hey, I still want to be in basketball. Maybe this coaching thing would be something I'd give a try. How would you describe yourself getting into coaching?
Evolution. I just evolved into it. And here's what I mean by that. Because I was so focused as a rebounder, I studied the game that way. That's rebound doctor. You know, I believe that everything ends and begins with the rebound. Your defense ends with the rebound. So I study defense. Your offense begins with the rebound. And so I study offense, and I coach out of that with me in the center. So when I was in college, though, and this is when this began, I studied my teammates. I knew their tendencies. I knew, you know, as far as trying to get second shot opportunities for our team, I really, and score points. That's how I did it. I studied them. I knew their like, you know, what they would likely do. And, you know, Tommy Green, our point guard, it was pretty simple. You know, he is going to jack the ball anytime he's around the top of the key. And his shot is always, most of the time, going to bounce straight back to him if it's a miss. So wherever I am on that court, I'm trying to get that edge and lean in that direction where I'm expecting that basketball to rebound to in order to get my hands on it. So I studied the game from rebounding. And that's why I say an evolution, because it just kind of grew into, it was like such a student of the game because of rebounding. It just continued on, you know. No, I never said that, you know, I want to coach. I just, opportunity came. I was blessed. I've been very blessed by basketball. The opportunity came, and then I fell in love with coaching.
All right, I'm not even going to attempt to go through all the different stops you've had on your coaching career. So give me maybe a highlight or two, or just maybe a quick summary of some of the places that you've had the good fortune to be able to coach, and then we'll work our way towards what you're doing now with Rebound Doctor and your individual skill development work, and then what you're doing at Wilberforce. So just kind of give us the summary of how you got there.
Yeah, yeah. I coach, I think most interesting stuff is when I coach internationally. And one of the teams that I coach was a team called the Mayas de Yucatan. And the Mayas de Yucatan played in the LNBP, which is the major league in Mexico. And so, of course, we were in the Yucatan. It was just a beautiful place, you know. The people were smaller, but then the basketball, it was just so unbelievably great. And we won a championship and everything, and the love of the game. And so I just have that. That was my best international experience, and still, you know, good friends with the guys, the two brothers that owned that team, and as well as some of the players that were from Mexico, and of course all of my All-American players from America. We're still really good friends to this day. But playing or coaching in the Yucatan was an incredible, just beautiful experience. The people of the Yucatan were wonderful. The city was great. And I learned a lot about Mexico. I didn't know that such great cities existed in Mexico, you know, by traveling through Mexico. It was just an unbelievable experience. And now I've been everywhere with the Globetrotters. I've been all over the place. But that experience as a coach in the Yucatan was one I'll never forget.
All right. I always ask this question. And since you played and coached overseas, I know you have one. Now you may not be able to share all of them, but what is your craziest overseas basketball story that you can share on a PG, on a PG rated podcast?
I don't think I have one. Put all the qualifications in. Let me think about that for a second, because there were so many great things that did happen. You know, I was there when the Pope was shot. Yeah, I think that's when.
Wow.
And yeah, and so of course, I'm trying to remember exactly where I don't know if I was in Italy. I don't know, but the media was crazy about it, you know, and we remember feeling like, man, let's get out of here, let's just go home, you know. And so that was kind of a crazy time, but. You know, on the PG side, you know, just events that could happen that could make it kind of crazy for you. We were blessed. We didn't have that much kind of stuff happening. Everything was just all about, you know, the fun that we were having and the love that we were sharing, being goodwill ambassadors and representing our country the best way that we could. And in my experience with the Globetrotters, that is exactly how I feel about what we were doing. People don't realize that being a goodwill ambassador was not just something that we said. That's who we were, and that's how we acted, and that's what we were with the Globetrotters. So it was more than basketball there. So most of the experiences were really wonderful. You know, the off the court experiences, like things happening, like they were just unbelievable, like meeting Stephen Stills or hanging out and partying and becoming really good friends. With Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, hanging out with the Rolling Stones. Who gets to do that, you know? So, you know, I've been so blessed with basketball. It's been a total blessing for me from I got the wind knocked out of me from that day forward. it's just been really a true blessing. And I have done a lot. I've been a lot of places, and I've had a lot of success, and I've had a lot of failure as well. But, you know, I'm phenomenally well-traveled and well-versed and full of wisdom, blessed to have been able to turn my experiences into wisdom and know how to use it. And so it's just been basketball has been a wonderful blessing for me.
All right. So that being said, let's fast forward to today and tell us a little bit about what you do at Wilberforce, what your role is. And then after you do that, tell us a little bit about what you do with your Rebound Doctor training business. And then after you do that, I think we're getting close to, we may have even blown past the hour and a half mark.
Oh, have we? Yeah, really?
We're close. I don't know. Again, every time I look up, I'm always amazed by, I'm like, that conversation went way too quickly. So share with us Wilberforce, share with us Rebound Doctor, and then we'll head towards wrapping things up.
Yeah, I'm proud to be going into my fourth season working with the Wilberforce Bulldogs. Wilberforce is a historically black college in Wilberforce, Ohio, which is right outside Xenia. Well, actually, it's in Xenia, so it's right outside of here, Dayton. And I had a good friend. I moved back to Dayton 4 years ago. For 4 years in July, I wanted to spend time with my father and my family. I'm based, I have a home still in Atlanta, and that's where I kind of traveled the world from. But I wanted to come home for a little while. Now I've been kind of stuck here. So, but when I first got here, a good friend of mine, he got the head men coaching job at Wilberforce, and he knew me very well, and he knew I moved back to Dayton, so he asked me would I come over and help him, you know? And after I thought about it, I'm like, well, okay, I will. And so I, you know, 4 years ago, I joined him at Wilberforce, but they couldn't pay me, so Wilberforce offered me a different job in order to be compensated to come up there, and I did that, and I worked with him, Coach Waters, and I worked with him, and that's how I got to work with the man, and we won a championship. We won a, you know, it's like the Christian College NIT is what it was called, but we were very proud to have won that championship, and so we brought some success together to our Wilberforce, and that's how I got to Wilberforce. I focused on player development and helping him, but it was more like everybody development, helping him, helping everything that was moving about the game, about what we were doing. But that's the only year I did the man. The athletic director at the time was also the head women's coach, and he convinced me to come and work with him. He wanted me to work with him, right? And so after much deliberation, because I never coached women before, and at the same time, that was intriguing. I switched over to working with the women. And so I became the skill enhancement coach, you know, with them. And of course, worked with our bigs. I worked with everybody as far as trying to do everything to help them prepare themselves both mentally and physically. And that's what I wanted to do. That's the role that I wanted to play. I didn't just want to be your standard every day. Nothing wrong with it because I've been assistant coach millions of times. But I wanted to have a different kind of impact based on where my career was going. There was nothing about coaching at Wilberforce that was going to help me get a job or anything. My resume is already well enough, you know, to do that. But it was because I wanted to really, you know, help those players get better at that level. And boy, did we ever, what happened is in that first year with the women, we were able to make it to our national tournament, you know, where NAIA school Division II. And that was historic. That was historic, you know. So I'm like, okay, this coach, this working with the woman thing is kind of fun. So then our next season, which was the past season together, we did it again, you know. And in fact, when we were in Iowa at the national tournament, which was this year, we were able to play our game because we opened it up. And then when that game ended, that's when the season ended for now. Everything was shut down, and that was a shocking time. But the point being that we went back to the Nationals. So we've had a lot of success. I've been having a lot of fun helping those young ladies and young men, you know, learn how to be, you know, my stuff is on the court and off the court. You know, our women's team are the best students on the campus. You know, two of them were co-valedictorians, you know, this past year, you know. And all of that is how we deal with our students and our athletes at Wilberforce, you know, by trying to make them, you know, pursue their dreams on their basketball court and pursue their dreams off of the court. And we've been very successful doing that. And I'm looking forward. I start next month for my fourth year there. And I'm going to go back to the women. I even turned down the men job opened up. I had no interest in doing that. Been there and done that.
You know? So what do you like about coaching the women? What is it about coaching the women that you've really taken to and enjoyed?
Well, it's more cerebral. Men play above the rim. Women don't. They play below the rim, you know. And so the player development aspect just becomes such a challenge and a focus. And it helped me become a better player development coach because, you know, they play with their exes. Women play with, to their exes and O's because they can't just jump over people and dunk on them, you know. And because men, guys can do that, they'll have more of a tendency to not be as disciplined of a player, you know, and even come to us with a lack of fundamental skills already, you know, things that you should have already had. It came from, you know, your high school and different things because coaches will just let you run, jump, and dunk. And so it became, you know, a good challenge. But women, they wanted that. They wanted the X. They want the X's and O's. It's almost like, gonna be crazy me saying this, but it's like a pure game, you know. And so I guess after all the games that I played and seen and done and coached and everything, I just liked how this looked and how I felt and just really learned to really respect these young ladies because they work hard, you know, they get it in, they love the game, you know, just as much as men do. And I think it was those things.
It's good stuff. I can totally relate to it. I've coached both at the high school level. I've only coached the boys, but I spent a lot of time coaching. I have two daughters, spent a lot of time coaching them. And I always have a blast when I'm coaching the girls teams for sure. You know, there's something different about the dynamic that makes it fun. It makes it different and it's enjoyable. And I always get a kick. Yep. No doubt. I always get a kick out of it. All right. Last thing, Rebound Doctor. Talk to me about what you're doing with your individual player development business and kind of what you're trying to get out of that. Let people know how they can find out about what you're doing. And then I'll jump back in and we'll start wrapping things up.
Okay. Well, rebounddoctor.net, that's the website. I'm actually about to launch a newer version of it. But rebounddoctor.net is up right now. And so anybody can go take a look at it and it tells a lot of the story. But what happened is that 5 years ago, I wanted to get into player development and I had a young guy that I used to, in my practices, he would be in the gym before us and I would notice him, he's over there working on all this stuff by himself. And so I'm watching him. So one time I went over to him, I'm like, son, what are you doing? And he said, I want to be a player development coach, you know. I've been working with this guy. I've been working with that guy as far as training stuff. So he was so good. I said, well, teach me some things. So he's my young guru. And that's when I got into it because it's a different game, focusing on player development as opposed to developing practice plans for a team. So I kind of got into it then and I kept growing in it. And so I wanted to, with Rebound Doctor, my goal is to create a situation where I coach anybody, but I specialize in big players. You know, you might have a kid that is in the ninth grade of high school and he might be 6'5" looking like he's going to turn to 6'8". And so the coach sometimes will just say, don't you leave this block. You just stay under the basket, you know. So I wanted to, my goal, you know, in the early going was to help players learn how to, big players learn how to do everything else, but do what they do best better by playing around the basket. And so that became my focus and going into my fifth year of it. And I have had some unbelievable clients, you know, coming up. I have a kid, I just call him Mike, from Mongolia, you know, 15 year old. He's 16 years old now. He's been all over the world playing in everything. Just from Mongolia, absolute phenom, you know. And I may even have something, come to find out his dad played with the Globetrotters. You know, he's Mongolian, he's 7 foot tall. And so he was just, you know, and just on and on and on. I was been blessed to have great players. And so I learned a lot from my players. So the basic thing about Rebound Doctor is a player development, or I call it a skill enhancement. Is our goal, and I work it through Coach Up. Coach Up is my back office, and that's a great company to do that with. And I love it, and I'm looking forward to. I have about, you know, just I haven't even been marketing it, but they kind of carry it over. I have about 30 clients that I owe about 60 sessions Then I have to get off of my books if I could ever get back in the gym.
Yep.
But basically, Rebound Doctor is a skill enhancement program, and I focus on all the things, not just basketball. Just how to live as well, and that's why some of my younger clients they love what we do. It's been a challenge with some of these kids because they want to do it all the time. Their parents are like, well, I can't afford to keep doing this, and it's not just been limited for me. Of course, I've had a lot of international, about 50-50 with international kids as well. I've just been blessed with that. So I keep it at the rate of how my basketball career was and, being on an international set as well as local players, and it's for women and men. And it's just wonderful. I love doing it. That's all I really want to do now. In fact, that's the spinoff is that's just what I do at Wilberforce, and it's all about helping people get better.
Lionel, it's great stuff. Before we wrap up, I want to give you one last opportunity. Share your social media, give people your website again, just so they can reach out to you, find you. If they have questions, if they just want to say thanks, if they have a question, just let them know how they can find you. And then I will jump back in and we will finish things up.
Okay. Well, you can easily find me on Facebook as far as the social network. And you just simply just search with my first and last name, Lionel Garrett. My first name is spelled L-I-O-N-E-L, and my last name is G-A-R-R-E-T-T. Everything that you really, that connects all those dots together would be my website, which is Rebound Doctor. And so it's a little tricky how I spell that Rebound Doctor. But the website for that is, of course, www.rebounddoctor.net. So you spell Rebound Doctor, R-E-B. OUNDDR.net. So it's two D's at the end. So that's rebounddoctor.net. REBOUNDDR.net.
Perfect. We're going to put all that in the show notes. So if anybody's listening to this in the car, they don't have to crash into a telephone pole trying to furiously scribble
that
down.
It's not that serious.
But we'll get that all in the show notes so people can find it. On a personal level, I can't thank you enough for being willing to jump on with us tonight and spend who knows how long here tonight talking. And it was just a pleasure for me on a personal level to get a chance to know you and hear your story. And it's always amazing to me the connections and the shared experiences that two people who have never met in the game of basketball can have. It's just incredible to me. And I can't thank you enough for being willing to hop on the Hoopheads pod with Jason and I. And he's off tending to his 5.5-month-old daughter right now. So I'm sure he would pass along the same thing to you. But we really appreciate it. And to everyone who's out there listening, thanks. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.